previously on Accused.
Well, I always like to think the best of people, and that the people who were in charge were competent and knowledgeable.
We won that case hands down. He didn't die of uranium poisoning. He died of a potassium deficiency.
We've had, you know, higher rates of leukemia, and we've had higher rates of breast cancer and kidney cancer and bone cancer and
lung disorders and stuff. I got that.
I got to go to dialysis 3 times a week.
That's the way the media does. That's what sells newspapers. Horror stories sell newspapers.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the mysterious death of David Box.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
As I reported this story about the Fernald atomic plant, I came across a man who could possibly be crowned the all-time king of conspiracy theories. His name was D.C. Cole, and he was a self-described investigative journalist darn near obsessed with Fernald. He's the reporter who got Unsolved Mysteries attention and landed the tale of David Box on an episode in 1994. On the episode, he made clear what he thought happened to David.
I think he knew something. And I think it had to deal with Plant 8. I think it had to deal with the releases, the threat to the public health and the environment. It's possible he was a whistleblower or was going to be a whistleblower.
Cole wrote a book about Fernald, which I've read. It is objectively not a good book. I'm not casting judgment on the conclusions he draws in it, but simply how it's written. It's disorganized and repetitive and poorly punctuated. Editors are our friends. Parts of it sound so far-fetched that I admit laughing out loud a few times while reading it. I was so floored by one paragraph that I even took a photo of it and texted it to Amanda Rossman, my producer. It read, quote, "Box may have also found Fernald's lab where government vultures were secretly mutilating dead bodies for the purpose of sending human body parts to Los Alamos, where they would be burned in a furnace for uranium analysis," end quote. Sounds pretty crazy, right? I thought so. And then I found a Los Angeles Times story from October 9, 1994, with this headline, "U.S. Accused of Stealing Body Parts." The subhead read, "Widow contends Energy Department workers took the evidence her husband died of uranium poisoning, his bones, liver, kidney, and spleen tissue. Government denies wrongdoing, but admits taking the items," end quote. Admits it, as in, yes, the government indeed snatched body parts from Fernald workers without the consent of the dead workers' families. A Mother Jones article titled Body Snatchers from 1991 also confirms D.C. Cole's assertion in broad strokes, if not the details. The bottom line is that no matter how crackpot-sounding some of Cole's theories were, some of it holds up a quarter century later. In this episode, we're going to look at the conspiracy theories surrounding David Box's death and explain which ones might be rooted in truth. When you see D.C. Cole in the Unsolved Mysteries episode, he makes an impression. His hair is shaggy, he's missing a couple of teeth, and he wears a cream-colored turtleneck beneath the sports coat. As I spent weeks looking for this guy, I stumbled on a few online message boards with comments about him.
If I were a kid, I'd buy a cheap turtleneck and some fake teeth and go as DC Cole for Halloween. People are mean.
The people who had actually met Cole weren't much kinder. Here's former Fernald employee Harry Easterling.
He was a jerk.
And here's retired detective Pete Alderucci.
We were looking at him and saying, this guy's crazy. And we just threw him out.
The more I heard about DC Cole, the more of a character he seemed. Tony Box, David's oldest son, said Cole wore a watch lined with chunky turquoise.
If you met him and didn't know he was a reporter, you'd think, this guy's just a getting ready to go out to South Dakota for the bike rally out there, you know?
Sturgis.
Yeah. You'd think, you know, he wasn't like a your traditional, in your mind, what you would think as a journalist, you know what I mean? He had a cowboy hat on, from what I can remember. I forget, he had a black shirt on, a black T-shirt, and I'm pretty sure it was like a biker-themed T-shirt that I can remember.
Yeah, turquoise and everything. That really does sound South. I lived in South Dakota. That sounds South Dakota.
I looked everywhere for this man and kept coming up empty. Cole is a common surname, and DC only wrote for some now-defunct underground publications. In his emails to David Box's children, he talks about mounds of research he's entrusted to a friend just in case something happens to him. Finding this guy became a mini obsession for me, so much so that I started recording my search.
So I had been looking all day for D.C. Cole, a self-described investigative reporter. I know that he exists or existed. I know that he wrote for an outlet called Everybody's News. I know that that also existed. I hadn't heard of it because it folded in 99, but I do have a record of it.
I emailed a former writer at Everybody's News, but she had no memory of a freelancer named DC Cole. Then I reached out to a Cincinnati journalist named John Fox, one of the creators of an alternative newspaper here called City Beat. Before Fox and friends created City Beat, which he still edits, he was
the editor of Everybody's News from 1991 to 1994.
Fox gave me what I desperately needed, which was DC's real first name, Danny. Danny Cole, middle initial C. Armed with that, I found Cole's 2016 obituary. I can't remember the last time I'd been so disappointed to learn of a complete stranger's death. I'd really wanted to interview him. It didn't make me less curious about him to find out he was dead. He was such an out-there personality with some of the wildest-sounding ideas, and yet he was right about some key things. I can't imagine how elated he would be to know that we picked up his investigation where he left off. His years of work weren't in vain. I kind of wish he'd lived to see that.
So he was super intense.
This is John Fox, who met Cole around 1992.
He came to me, you know, this was back in the day. We were a free, every other week newspaper. We didn't pay our writers. So in some ways, we were sort of very open to people who just show up with stories. But at the same time, I wasn't just going to take anything that anybody brought in off the street. So Danny comes in. Like a lot of people, I've got this great story and you're going to love it and it's going to change the world and we're going to get these guys.
Cole had a strange, relentless energy to him. He seemed more caricature than man.
I remember as I got to know him over time, I would always try to take him out to lunch. It seemed like he never ate. All he did was drink coffee. So he seemed to live on coffee. So he was super caffeinated, super intense. Was really kind of a rough around the edges guy. He had some teeth missing. He looked like he was not well himself, but he would never really talk about that.
Cole showed Fox some writing samples and said he had grown up about a mile from Fernald. That was his initial draw, he said. He wanted to figure out what exactly had happened at the plant because, according to him, it forever affected his family.
He did talk about how his mom was dying of cancer. And how pretty much everyone he grew up with in that area was either sick or dead. And so it was a very personal story for him. once, because he told me that when he was a kid growing up a mile from Fernald, like everyone, they were told that something else was going on there. They were lied to. And so once he found out what was really going on there, and then once I think he put two and two together, he made it his life's work to try to share what he thought was going on. And that, I think, to get back at the people who he feels like, felt like had destroyed his life and his family's life.
Cole wrote a four-part series for Everybody's News in 1992 that suggested radioactive waste had flowed for years from Fernald down the Great Miami River towards Cincinnati's water supply. As a sidebar in that series, he wrote a first-person story about life on River Road within a mile of the Fernald plant. He wrote about his uncle John, whose mother died of cancer and whose father died of thyroid disease. John's half-sister, Cole's mother, had heart disease, Cole wrote, and John was in and out of hospitals with various ailments. Cole said he suspected all of the family's illnesses were tied to Fernald. It's a kind of guerrilla journalism I can't imagine doing, but I admit I respect it in a strange way. He discloses his connection, which is important, and you certainly can't accuse the guy of lacking passion. What's most fascinating to me about this guy are the conclusions he reaches in the self-published book. I'm using the term book here, but the copy David's daughter shared with me is actually a hard-covered three-ring binder filled with about 180 computer page printouts. It's called Box Conspiracy, Night of the Living Dead at Fernald. There's apparently a copy housed at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. I have no idea how Cole managed that. What Cole posits in his book is not just that David Box was murdered, but that the cover-up into the death included his supervisors, his co-workers, the government, the police, and even the Box's family lawyer, who was hired months after David's last shift. Cole suggests that Harry Easterling, the man with whom David carpooled, seemed too worried about his friend to have had nothing to do with the disappearance. He took Alderucci's dismissal of his questions as defensiveness and decided the detective must have been on the take. Employees who worked third shift with David, from security guards to David's supervisor, each had doubt cast upon him. A quote from page 174. Furthermore, one doesn't need to be some kind of expert on the mafia in order to see the tentacles of an organized crime family all over this case. DOE and the mob are working together as one. To be clear, Cole isn't the only subscriber to conspiracy theories when it comes to Fernald in general, and David in particular. We encountered a lot of unverifiable info presented as fact. We encountered it so much, in fact, that I was starting to wonder if the act of working at Fernald might itself play a role in paranoia. Well, at least one doctor thought so. In 1994, Dr. Jacob Lindy, a professor at the University of Cincinnati and a member of the Cincinnati Psychoanalytic Institute, testified that Fernald workers showed signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. He said, quote, "They've gone through an experience that they feel no one else understands. What you thought was safe isn't any longer," end quote. Lindy, testifying in a trial that pitted 7,000 former Fernald workers against National Lead of Ohio, said he studied workers and found they demonstrated at least twice as much paranoia, depression, anxiety, compulsive behavior, and somatic disorders than retired workers from another company called Heekin Can, where employees did pretty much the same type of jobs, but with metals that weren't radioactive. This makes it tough to know how to weigh some of the claims we heard from former workers. It's possible that what some of them say is true, but we're, of course, on guard, just in case. For example, Hillary Webb Jr., whose father spent decades working at Fernald and ultimately died of cancer, issued a concerning warning to us.
"You're not going to get the truth, girls. And if you get the truth, then you better start packing, because your life is in danger."
He said he personally was threatened over the years. Here's one such story.
They've murdered people. That guy in that furnace was murdered. I was threatened twice by guys in black suits. I mean, you hear them UFO idiots going off. Oh, the black suit guys came. Well, I was working at Varney's, driving the truck, and car pulled up out of the parking lot in the morning. He walked out and asked him who the hell they were. And the guy said, you got a guy here by the name of Webb? Yep, good friend of mine. I were waiting to see him. Here's, can I ask you why? Because, you know, a lot of trucks running in, they're afraid he might get hurt or hit or anything. And they said, we'll wait. Gary goes in back in the office. I come in about 5 o'clock and I roll up in the garage. But he told me, he said, Webb, come to the office. And he said, there's two guys out there in a car. He said, it's gray. And wearing black suits and they want to see you. I said, really? Yep. Now, my dad was already doing that case with Chelsea in Cincinnati for all the people. And I had the gun in the car. And when I walked out to the car, they were parked next to me. Out of the car they come. And as I get maybe from here to there, and they said, who are you? I said, my name's Webb. Why? Who are you? They said, well, we want to talk to you. I said, what do you want to talk to me about? So we want to talk to you about Fernald. I said, hell. I looked around. I said, what's this place got to do with Fernald? He said, well, your dad's down there in this lawsuit with them. Said they're not going to win it. And so we understand that you and your dad are running around running your mouth. I said, you copping an attitude on me, buddy? I said, I can settle this real quick. And he said, no. He said, we just want to let you know that if you get into this any deeper, or you pursue this, and things could happen. So I sort of moved to the right side of my Eclipse, and I bent down and grabbed my .45, and I laid it up on top of the hood, on the top of the car. I said, I don't need to wait for things to happen. I said, it can happen right now. I said, if you're threatening me, buddy, I'm going to put you down. I got 6 kids, and they ain't nobody threatening me. I said, no, I've never let nobody threaten me.
He also told a story from earlier in his life when he was just a kid. He told classmates that his dad made atomic bombs. After school that day, he said a different set of men in black awaited him. They lifted him by his arms, walked him to a secluded area, and told him never to tell anyone what his dad did for a living.
When I got home, they had already been to the house on Dad. And it scared me. I went running it to the door to Dad. Dad grabbed me and brought me. He goes, did you tell them people I built nuclear bombs? Yep. And I said, I told them also you was going to bomb the hell out of Russia.
It's scary stuff that I have no way to verify. And it extends to David's case specifically. Webb said his dad had at first been really defensive of Fernald, even back when Hillary was an elementary school student. The two would butt heads over whether the plant was safe.
I was in the third grade telling Dad that they were killing him because we were watching movies about Hiroshima that the government made, and Dad's working in it. Son, you're lying. I asked my daughter, me and my dad argued all of our life, up until when that man ratted to Channel 5 about the flumes and all the stuff blowed through the stacks out there in Ross. And Dad knew that before the man died. He was telling people that man that they found in the furnace.
Okay, that's what you think that box talked to Channel 5?
I heard Dad talking about 10 of them at the house one day. I was in bed, 11 o'clock at night, here comes these guys. And they said, Webb said there's a Channel 5 news guy out in the parking lot. And rumor has it that there's someone in here talking about the radiation leaks. Dad and all of them are going, but there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, this was about a month. A month later, they find he disappears. And it takes them about a week to find him. So everybody knew who this guy was. I don't know his name, but they did, those guys that worked there, and they knew he was ratting. And then once it came to light about this radiation being blown in the air and poisoning everybody down there and it down in the aquaflow, then Dad come to me and said, son, I should have believed you. You were smarter than me in the third grade.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
And now back to our story. David's family was hearing similar tales from D.C. Cole. His son Tony says he was keen to co-sign some of the conspiracy theories back then too. And yet, even to him, Cole was a bit much.
I sort of felt that in a lot of ways he was a little bit overboard on things, you know.
He's like, interesting.
He was saying that he was thinking that Dad knew and was ready to blow the whistle on things that would tumble humongous, you know, high government officials.
Casey Box Drake, David's daughter, didn't know what to make of Cole at first either. She remembers how determined he was to nail the government and how stoked he'd been when Unsolved Mysteries called. The producers had interviewed four people on the record: Casey, Cole, and co-workers Harry Easterling and David Day. Robert Stack also talked about an additional unnamed source whose identity Casey still doesn't know. Casey and Cole corresponded via email for years, but after he finished his book and gave it to her to read, they had a falling out. She saved printouts of their email exchanges with his three-ring book and a tear-out from Harper's Bazaar. During one of our interviews, she made it clear that was a pun.
You see what I have here, right?
No, you didn't. She put bizarre.
I asked if she remembered the last time she spoke with Cole.
It was over the phone. This is our depositions.
Oh, great. Okay.
That's what this is. It was over the phone, and I was finally to the breaking point where I was just done talking to him, because he, after all this and the Unsolved Mysteries thing, I talked to him for a little bit longer, and I had just come to the conclusion nothing is ever going to get resolved with this. And he just kept coming up with all, he would go off on these tangents on conspiracy here and conspiracy there and trying to tie it all together, and the government was going to kill him, and they were, you know, finally I was like, look, dude, too much. I don't want anything else to do with you. Leave me alone. And that was probably 15, 18 years ago.
Her emails around that time make it clear she was frustrated. Here's how one begins from August 2004. DC, that was a rather sensational little story you have conjured up there. I mean, you should win an Oscar for that one. Can I play myself in the movie? Do I sound sarcastic? Good, that is what I was going for. Some of the stuff you wrote was absurd. I especially liked how you misquoted everyone. I also wonder how you got the majority of your information. It's no wonder someone tried to kill you. Casey latches on to the grand scope of the conspiracy Cole lays out in his book. She says he pulled some of the names out of his ass and suggests that he forgot to include Santa Claus in the cover-up. After all, she wrote, who else has access to so many people in 24 hours? In the letter, she says she believes his intentions are good and that there is a cover-up. She agrees with Cole on that, but his book promises that the mystery has been unsolved until now, and she demands proof. She writes, "I have listened for years to you say, I have these bastards, but the only thing you have is a bunch of worthless paper with ink on it that you wrote. A judge is not going to read your story and say, oh, D.C. Cole wrote this. It must be true." If you ever wondered, there is a reason Amanda and I don't promise endings, happy or otherwise, when we start these investigations. We promise we'll give their loved ones the attention they deserved and tell their story the best we can, but that's all we can promise. These families have been through so much. False hope is cruel. Cole's certainty that this cover-up included everyone but Santa Claus is aided by a few facts that I'll chalk up to coincidence, though I do admit there's a few more of them than usual. Number one, David's psychiatrist was a man named Clifford Gruley III. His father and grandfather were both prominent doctors in this area. David's Dr. Gruley provided police with some early information about David's mental state. He gave them notes from his therapy sessions and detailed the issues David faced when hospitalized back in the 70s. He told them he did not believe David was suicidal. Gruley didn't get to testify to this at the trials related to David's death, though, because on October 2, 1985, he was found seated in a wooden chair in his bathroom, a shotgun blast through his head. His death was ruled a suicide, according to his autopsy report. Coincidence number two. We talked about David's brothers in an earlier episode. One of those brothers, Peter Box, lived with David until around 1983, the year before David disappeared. After David vanished, Peter was the family member who tried to keep up on the mortgage. He even went to Fernald to collect David's last paycheck. The family says Peter never believed the suicide theory, and Cole describes him as pestering law enforcement for answers. On January 24, 1988, Peter was walking to his third shift job at a motel in Milford, Ohio, when a vehicle slammed into him and sped away. Peter was airlifted to a hospital where doctors tried in vain to save him. He died at age 45. No one has ever stepped forward with any information on the hit-and-run driver.
Mm-hmm. And D.C. Coles had that tied into Dad's death, too.
What do you think of that theory?
It's plausible. I mean, if my dad wasn't like John F. Kennedy getting shot, and it's still that kind of a... I think he was putting my dad's death with that kind of a conspiracy theory.
Coincidence number three. Some of the lawyers in the many lawsuits over the years overlap to what some might consider an inappropriate degree. For example, Stan Chesley represented residents and workers in class action lawsuits, and some of his firm's associates handled individual workers' comp cases as well. According to Cole, Chesley represented a life insurance company that happened to be David's life insurance company. If David's death had been ruled a homicide, that company would have had to pay out to his children. This overlap caused Cole to wonder if Chesley, arguably the region's most famous lawyer, had put any pressure on David's estate lawyer to pull his punches when fighting the suicide theory in order to save a big insurance company client some money. I reached out to the Box's main lawyer, Stephen Martin, but he didn't return my messages. After leaving private practice, he served for more than 20 years as a Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas judge. He was unseated in the November 2018 election. Stan Chesley also didn't respond to our interview requests. If I were D.C. Cole, I'd see a conspiracy of silence here. But then, sometimes people just don't like talking to journalists. David's family always had questions about their lawyer's decisions. For example, both Casey and Tony told me that their mother had wanted to sue Fernald for wrongful death, but they said the lawyers convinced her that governmental immunity would shield National Lead of Ohio and the DOE, so she should only sue for workman's comp.
We went through stuff for years and years with my dad's, and, you know, the whole thing with my dad. I mean, them trying to get, you know, get him pronounced dead, and then trying to fight with Fernald to get some kind of benefit, because, you know, we were all under age when it happened, but by the time any type of payout, Social Security or whatever, finally started paying out, the only one that was still underage was my younger brother.
And those payments stop when you're 18.
Right.
Aside from those meager Social Security checks, the kids got nothing. No life insurance, no workers' comp, and certainly no wrongful death settlement. As the decades have passed, David's family's concerns about the lawyers involved have grown rather than subsided. This wasn't helped by Chesley's ultimate disbarring in Kentucky and resignation in Ohio. Chesley, after decades of winning high-profile case after case, earning him the gauche title Master of Disaster, fell from grace when he allegedly stole millions of dollars from his clients. That story began when Chesley and several other attorneys filed a suit against American Home Products, the maker of the diet drug Fen-Phen. The plaintiffs in that class action suit negotiated a $200 million settlement in 2001, but the lawyers skimmed extra for themselves as supposed fees. Chesley avoided paying that money back for years by hiding assets in a, quote, high-stakes shell game, end quote. That's from a federal appeals ruling. The case led to one judge and five lawyers, including Chesley, being permanently disbarred. Two of the lawyers were convicted of wire fraud and sentenced to prison. Chesley avoided prosecution by testifying against his co-counsel. In 2018, 17 years after the settlement had been reached, he admitted through his lawyers to unjust enrichment and agreed to pay $23.5 million back to his clients. When Box's family saw the greed on display in that case, it made D.C. Cole's crazy conspiracy theory about colluding lawyers seem all the more plausible. I have no evidence that anything untoward there happened, but appearances do matter.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
I have been wanting to upgrade my bedding for a while, but I wasn't sure where to start. Then I heard about Boll & Branch, and I am so glad I gave them a shot. I decided to go with a classic white sheet look, a huge upgrade from the faded purple sheets that I probably bought in college. The first thing I noticed was how soft the material was. They're really the softest and most comfortable sheets in the world. And by the way, the only bedding loved by three U.S. presidents. I couldn't wait to get into bed with these sheets, which actually made me end my night a little bit earlier. Anything that encourages more sleep is a win in my book. I stayed cool and comfortable the whole night and woke up feeling refreshed. Right now, for a limited time, you can get their luxury flannel bedding to keep you cool sleepers warm and, because they breathe, keep the warm sleepers cool. Shipping is always free. You can try them out for 30 nights risk-free, and right now, you get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com with promo code ACCUSED. That's $50 off at bollandbranch.com, promo code ACCUSED. That's spelled B-O-L-L and branch.com, code ACCUSED.
And now back to our story. The body snatching claim was one of D.C. Cole's wildest, and yet it was mostly true. Only mostly because entire bodies weren't stolen. Instead, it went like this. A Fernald worker would die, and either his doctor or his employer, National Lead of Ohio, would alert the county coroner. The coroner had the right to claim cases he wanted to investigate. Once a case was officially under coroner jurisdiction, the coroner could take organ samples without consulting the dead person's family. If you think about it, it makes sense. Coroners investigate causes of death. Those investigations can't be dependent on a family member saying, "Sure, go ahead, investigate." Imagine if the death was murder. Imagine if the killer was a family member. The case that brought this practice to light was that of Larry Hicks, the man mentioned in an earlier episode, who died 5 days after being doused with uranium particles. Hicks's physician alerted the coroner to his death and told the coroner that recent workplace exposure to uranium oxide and/or dioxide might have caused or contributed to Hicks's demise. The coroner designated Hicks's death a coroner's case and ordered a radioisotope laboratory to perform a whole-body radioactive count to make sure performing an autopsy was even safe. A few days later, the coroner, a doctor named Frank Cleveland, got a call from NLO offering the services of the United States Uranium Registry, which until 1992 was run by the Hanford Environmental Health Foundation. The registry, launched in 1968 and used tissue samples and autopsy findings to research the effects of uranium exposure. The coroner said sure and sent the registry some of Hicks's organs and tissues for testing. Now, Hicks's widow, Diane, wouldn't have known about this testing were it not for the fact her husband was basically hollow when he reached the funeral home. A relative told me that his chest was visibly sunken and had to be internally padded by the mortician to fill out his suit. Diane sued, calling the organ removal a clandestine and ghoulish operation. Larry was missing bones, his liver, his kidneys, and tissue from his spleen. He still had his heart. This is all noteworthy because while it was Larry's heart that stopped, the human heart isn't where you would best be able to test for uranium exposure. I quote from a 2013 CDC public health statement. Uranium that is absorbed is deposited throughout the body. The highest levels are found in the bones, liver, and kidneys. In other words, when Diane Hicks decided she'd like to have independent testing to confirm NLO's assertion that her husband's death was from a potassium deficiency, she couldn't because the organs most likely to show uranium poisoning had disappeared. Hicks's lawsuit was filed in 1985, a few months after her husband died. She lost in 1986. She kept fighting, appealing to the state Supreme Court, and ultimately failed there too. Her case has been cited as legal precedent in several other Supreme Court cases. Because NLO argued that Hicks's death had nothing to do with him being doused in uranium 5 days before his heart stopped, the death was ruled to be non-work related, and Diane wasn't even granted workers' compensation. She was left to raise her 3 kids alone. Diane is still alive, and we spoke briefly. She sounded eager to share her story, parts of which she shared here and there over the decades. Unfortunately, as eager as Diane sounded when we talked, I learned from one of her children that she now suffers from dementia and has more bad days than good. I decided not to include her voice here. I want to note, though, that Diane's fight wasn't totally in vain. Her lawsuit brought the so-called body-snatching practice to light. Legal or not, taking people's organs without family's consent is kind of creepy. Creepy enough that the case was featured in the LA Times, in Mother Jones, and on TV tabloid shows. It even helped shape the careers of some doctors so shocked by the practice that they spoke out at the time, doctors like David Eggleman, who in the 1994 LA Times article condemned the act as an unethical and evil conspiracy. I tracked down Eggleman today, and he's stayed the course professionally. He's a professor of family medicine at Brown University who recently testified as an expert in a lawsuit filed by women who said they got ovarian cancer from exposure to Johnson & Johnson baby powder.
I've made it out a career out of publishing shit like that, yes. I'm in the credit-giving business. When companies do studies that show or know that the products they make are killing people, I give them credit for that. Sometimes the companies are not, they're very modest, these corporations, and they don't want to take credit for killing people and making a lot of money out of that. I haven't figured that out exactly why.
D.C. Cole's book includes mention of Larry Hicks. In fact, Cole writes that he only learned of David's story after tips came in following a 1992 article in Everybody's News called A Fernald Widow's Horror Story, which is especially telling in that Larry Hicks died the year after David Box. If Diane Hicks hadn't fought so hard, Cole wouldn't have started his investigation. Without his investigation, we might not be here today. Cole, for me, is both a larger-than-life character and a mystery man. I have put feelers out trying to find the friends he supposedly sent his documents to for safekeeping, but I've never found one. I haven't found mention of him in old newspapers. He doesn't appear to have gotten a higher profile job than some free alt-weeklies, and his affiliation with those even got strained with time. Here's John Fox, the former editor of Everybody's News.
So Danny continued to do stories for us over a period of time. I can't remember. It was at least a year. They weren't all Fernald-based, but that was his thing.
Cole pitched a story about a chemical treatment company that he thought was up to no good.
So Danny was convinced that the government was secretly shipping radioactive waste in barrels from Oak Ridge to Cincinnati, where these companies were then mixing it with non-radioactive waste, repackaging it, and sending it off to other places to be buried in the ground or disposed of in some way.
If Cole could confirm this, it'd be a big story. It would mean that the government was basically camouflaging its radioactive waste to get away with burying it somewhere it shouldn't be buried.
So he was pursuing this, and one day I got a call from a lawyer for this company who said that somebody named D.C. Cole had climbed a fence and was like snooping around their private property and had been arrested. And he said he was writing a story for you, and, you know, we need to talk to you because you're not allowed to do that. And I remember I actually had to go meet with some lawyers, their lawyers, and they were, I think I was actually even deposed. But, you know, I just said to Danny when after it was, I said, you can't do that, you know, and he's like, yeah, but they were doing bad things in there and I had to find out what they were. And I knew that I could see it through the fence, and I had to get up close and take a picture of it. And so that's where, you know, again, a trained journalist versus somebody who is on a mission to bring down the bad guys and stick it to the man. And that was pretty much it. I just said, we can't. First of all, I'm not going to put, I mean, this is a newspaper that is barely surviving. I'm not going to put the newspaper at risk over what you're doing as a freelancer. And secondly, I already told you weren't supposed to do this. Not literally this, but you just can't, you know, there has to be a line as a journalist between, trying to find the story and jumping fences, breaking the law, lying to people, that kind of thing, stealing things from people.
Just to be clear, we're not supposed to do those things?
We're not supposed to do those things.
Cole wasn't the first journalist to cross over into activism, nor was he the first to be fired for it. Fox felt bad about it, but despite what some might have you believe about the press, we have rules in journalism, and if you break those rules, you break trust. That's a big no-no. Amanda asked,
because,
do you remember how he took it?
Oh, he was devastated, you know. But again, that's the difference. It's like I want to publish good, well-written, well-researched stories that are going to make a difference. But again, like we said earlier, if the man gets stuck or not is sort of beyond, is not one of our goals here. And I'm certainly not going to put the welfare of the entire company at risk just so you can stick it to the man. And that's it. We have to draw the line. That's the difference between a journalist and what you're doing. And I said, since now you're over here, then I just can't have you involved with the paper. And I think I still saw him maybe a couple of times after that. You know, he would call me up and tell me what he was working on, but we were done working together.
Fox suspects that Cole got further telling his story than he ever expected to. He made the front page. Granted, it was a small newspaper that would fold in a few years, But anyone who's had a front page byline knows that feels like a big deal, even if it really isn't. But there's a fine line journalists must walk. We can believe passionately in the truth and in trying to reach the public with that truth, but we generally have to stop short of hoping for a specific outcome. Fox came to understand that Cole had a goal in mind.
He was just trying to, I think, exact some revenge for what the Fernald folks and the government had done to him and his family. And I think he had a taste of having some impact, and he had so many ideas and so many bad people doing bad things that he wanted to uncover.
It seems Cole's professional apex was likely his appearance on Unsolved Mysteries. The show, much like our podcast, aimed to jog memories loose, so producers provided an 800 number people could call and an address to write. Viewers responded. The phone calls were dictated and passed along to Cole and Casey, while the letters were photocopied. I'm going to read some of the messages, but not because they're true. I think it's interesting insight to see what kinds of responses people get when their story becomes national news. The sheer variety in tidbits and theories is fascinating. One caller said he knew of another man, not David Box, who had been killed driving a load of uranium. Quote, caller was told that the truck ran off the road and he was killed. Caller does not feel that this is a true story. Caller says that a lot of stories go around that plant. He knows the plant is not safe. End quote. The message closes with the anonymous messenger saying that he would not testify in court if he were asked. Another caller said he was a former NLO supervisor who'd worked alongside David. He said David was not suicidal. Quote, caller says that this was a government cover-up. The Department of Energy is involved, that there is a serious health threat in the area. Caller believes that this man knew what was going on. End quote. Another call. Quote, caller says when someone commits suicide, they will usually clean up house, pay all their bills, and complete unfinished business and go grocery shopping. Caller is certain that David committed suicide. All the signs were there. End quote. And another. Quote, caller is a psychic. Caller states that Dave tripped into the melting pot and that the company may have been involved with organized crime. End quote. Someone called to complain that the show's narration could have been better. Another caller said former President Jimmy Carter was to blame for David's death. Someone else wove a yarn so unbelievable that the receptionist taking notes wrote, quote, took a while to figure it out. This woman is a nutball. End quote. That ended with 3 exclamation points. Several callers said they'd seen David alive somewhere. In Sandusky, Ohio, in St. Louis, Missouri, in North Platte, Nebraska, in Milledgeville, Georgia, in Burlington, Vermont. Police at the time didn't put much stock into any of the theories floated by Unsolved Mysteries producers or viewers. In fact, investigator Victor Corelli said on the show,
no one ever gave us any indication or reason to believe that foul play may have occurred.
After reading the official case file, I'm comfortable saying outright, that's just not true. Next time on Accused.
But no one ever gave us any indication or reason to believe that foul play may have occurred.
How could he get into that furnace? You know, other than himself jump in.
It was probably lowered into the furnace that he was probably murdered.
A lot of people said, well, he jumped in there, he committed suicide. No, he did not.
To binge this season, go to www.wondery.com/plus. That's WONDERY.com/PLUS. To support the creators of Accused directly, go to our Patreon page where donors get bonus content and early episodes. That's at patreon.com/accused. This is a special project from the Cincinnati Enquirer, part of the USA Today Network, narrated by Amber Hunt, produced by Amanda Rossman, engineered by Phil Didion, and edited by Amy Wilson. Intern Mark Rosenberg provided additional research. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. To look at case documents, photos, videos, and more, visit accusedpodcast.com. As noted, some audio comes from a Living History project from the Fernald Community Alliance. Transcripts to those interviews are available at fernaldcommunityalliance.org.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.